The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So although Herschel Walker lost that Senate seat in Georgia, two other black Republicans, John James and Wesley Hunt, won their seats to the House, doubling the number of black Republicans in the lower chamber from 2 to 4. So why are we seeing more black Republicans both amongst voters and politicians? What's happening? What's going on there? And how does this impact the future of the Republican Party? So today, I'm really excited to welcome to the conversation David Dent, who is a professor of journalism and social and cultural analysis at New York University. He's the author of the book, In Search of Black America. And I want to engage him on this moment, what it looks like, what it really means, what's really going on. And is there something for both parties to embrace or be concerned about? We're going to have that discussion coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, everybody, I'm so glad you could join in on this conversation with my guest, David Dent. This is something I've been looking forward to. I told him before we got started that I had been reached out to about him and something he had written, and I read it, and I was like, I got to get this brother on to talk about the state of and development and growth of you know, black Republicanism, and the piece that we specifically read and referred to was this piece you had in the Rolling Stone, Why Are More Black Men Voting Republican? We'll get into that. But first, let me just welcome you, David, to the conversation, man. It's so good to have you on board. And given the way you've approached this, and how you've kind of looked at the narrative, what is your, you know, 3,000-foot view of the state of Republicanism? And then, of course, this little crazy niggly thing that's been around since the late 1850s with black Republicans.
Both are like really interesting. I think the long-term picture of the GOP, I mean, we've been saying for years, years now, Donald Trump, that's it. He really blew it this time. Donald Trump, that's it. I think maybe we are at a point, kind of perhaps with the rise of DeSantis and others, where that is it for Trump's influence. I'm not sure we can say that with much confidence on some level, though, when you really look at the polling. And while he doesn't carry a majority of the American public, he does carry a significant number of support from a significant number of people in the Republican Party now, which, of course, as we know, creates headaches for the leadership that wants to desperately move on beyond Trump and Trumpism to some extent, so the party can genuinely expand. So I think that that's one thing that really clouds the capacity of really seeing what is the long term.
Right.
In terms of African Americans, I think that there are levels of appeal for the GOP that on some level may transcend Trumpism and may transcend, and this is for just a pocket of the African-American population. I would not say the majority, but I would say a growing minority that really do subscribe to the partisan, to the perceptions of partisanship, and that's really steeped in, I say, mythology, and I say popularized perceptions that aren't right. always reality. Like the GOP is the party for fiscal, you know, fiscal conservatism.
Right.
And, you know, and there's a large number of African-American men who have joined the Republican Party because of the, for the same reasons that many white men joined the party, because they subscribe to that notion that it is the party that will take care of finances in a more responsible way. And so they may say, some of them even said this, well, racism is part of American life and part of the fabric of the American existence. So why let that necessarily be the larger influence of what drives me in terms of party? That is, that was a really widely held view of many of the men that I've interviewed that moved into the Republican Party, as well as some women. So I think that, you know, when you really look at, can the party reclaim what it was in the days of Lincoln in terms of
right.
African Americans, we're a long way from that.
Right.
You know, but can it continue to dip into on the Democratic lock on the black vote? Yes. And it could continue to do that. And the question is, how meaningful is that?
Right.
And will that be in terms of its impact on Democrats across the country?
I mean, I think you lay out a very interesting case for caution here. Let's not get over hyperextended about jumping on black folks suddenly now becoming Republicans. It reminds me of when I got elected chairman, and one of the members after my election, while I was going back into the hall, came up, gave me a big hug and said, oh, I'm so excited. This is such a wonderful day. Now blacks will join the Republican Party. I'm like, no, they won't. They're not going to wake up tomorrow and go, oh, they elected a black man chairman. Let me go out and become a Republican. You got to do the work. You're going to have to put in the time. And there's a lot of noise right now about seemingly around the efforts that the RNC and others have made to attract the black vote. I say opening up a center in a neighborhood is not the same as actually engaging on black issues. And certainly catering to sort of the machismo that exists within the black community the same way it does within the Hispanic community, again, is not engaging on the issues that are going to result in long-term solutions. You make the point, I think absolutely correctly, that, you know, black men joining the party around this notion that we're the party that's going to protect their pocketbook and going to advocate for, you know, fewer tax dollars and less government regulation. Well, we ain't done that shit in a long time. I mean, that we just haven't. I mean, I can actually point to the last time it was done. I was chairman of the RNC. So there is a very long stretch of road that the party has kind of moved away from that I don't think. And again, look, I believe in the validity of the system such as it is, and ways you can make it better by making sure that everyone gets to play on all sides. But we've got to be honest about what the play is, and we've got to be honest about what happens once you get inside.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that is what's interesting to me is that I think in terms of partisan choice, that Americans, regardless of race, are vulnerable to really the perception set forth by the better marketers of, and the Republicans market much more, I would say, often are better market party in a much stronger way than the Democrats do. So the creation of a perception of a party to do the things that they don't really do. But yet when people embrace the notion that's, you know, that reflects reflects that marketing, that really is what we see now.
Mm-hmm.
The increasing number of Black men joining the GOP. And I would argue that is really, in large part, one of the reasons why the Republican Party is stronger among men in general across racial lines.
So that you raise an interesting point that actually, I at least believe is part of the impetus of the book that you wrote back in 2000, In Search of Black America, Discovering the African American Dream. In that one, you went out on this sort of cross-country road trip where, you know, you went to art galleries and schools and bowling alleys. You went where real people were hanging out, college campuses and the like, and spent a lot of time, you know, at summer homes and rodeos. And, you know, you're just a brother out there, put the boots on and went out into the field, right? And you wanted to try to uncover what was going on in the lives of Black Americans at that time. And this is 2000, so we're talking 22 years ago. What appears to be different in that storyline about the world you observed in 2000 compared to what you know today and see today?
What an amazing question. Well, for one, I've actually thought about that a lot. And what's interesting is the book came out in 2000. A lot of the travels were done in the 90s. So,
right.
So that's what's, and of course, this was the pre-Obama, pre-Michael Steele America, and the pre-Obama look at Black America. I mean, where this was, I guess, In Search came out, the year of the Bush, the year Bush beat Gore.
Right.
And everything, the drama that came with all of the Bush-Gore race in Florida. I think that one of the things that I saw that was interesting was, I think, the possibility of an Obama, not that it would have been Barack Obama, but the possibility of an African-American who could appeal to the heartland based on his or her own values that were compatible with the heartland. And of course, we look at how Barack Obama was raised by his grandparents primarily. And so I think that, you know, without having a crystal ball and seeing the coming of Obama, I saw that there was something out there that could cross racial lines, because
right.
Really I saw a large, a patriotic population of people in our communities,
mm-hmm.
Who also carry the disgust over the racism that has, that has impaired the American dream, being a full, having, I guess you could say, African Americans having full custody of that, full and fair custody. But, you know, I saw, you know, a real patriotic and belief in America that I think we don't really associate with African-Americana often.
No, we don't.
And, you know, I think that was something that was very, very so apparent across certain lines too. I mean, that from working class African Americans,
the working class
upper class, upper income working I mean, that was very much a staple. And, and there were variations of that. So I think that that's something that I think has, that as African-Americans, you know, decide to embrace the whole of the American experience and what it offers, to some extent, that is a part of what I think Obama helped to promote. And I think perhaps laid the foundation for perhaps partisan experimentation within the African-American community.
What do you see, on that point, how do you see, because you talk about, you know, the African-American lived experience of the 90s and in 2000 versus where we see ourselves today. You mentioned a little bit ago that among especially probably African-American men, the attitude, you know, is like, okay, I relate to this idea of economy and wealth creation, and this party is going to deliver that. And given all the racism, well, you just kind of, I don't see how a Black man, and I'm going to stick with the Black man because everyone's focused on how Black men are making this move. I don't see how a Black man can just discount that. I certainly don't inside this party, knowing when I stepped into it, what is latter 20th century history had morphed into after the Southern strategy and things like that, with a desire to A, call it out, expose it, and change it, not accept it, not be, well, that's just part of the game. How do they reconcile that? Because I would think that only works up to the point that you can't get a loan, move into a neighborhood or expand your business because of race and racism.
It's fascinating because I see that and agree. I think part of it, first of all, there are people who look on the other side the Democratic side.
Right.
And see that this perhaps is pre-Obama, but even not necessarily from the eyes of others, and see that there is, racism in terms of the distribution of resources. I mean, even with an African-American chairman of the DNC, the rumblings I've heard from African-American Democrats and African-American voting rights activists and people who were really involved in voter turnout, Southern Wisconsin and Georgia, there was a lot of rumbling about the way in which the DNC distributed resources, right, and the way the DNC was appealing to the African-American community. And, you know, even some of the idea that the party was trying to, was trying to play that game that was played pre-Obama, and showing that we're not that, you know, we're not a Black party, we're for everybody, in order to try to make the party appear comfortable for the white working class.
Right.
There are a lot of rumblings about that within the Democratic Party. So I think that it is the idea that among some, and to me, I have the same reaction that you do in many respects, that I don't see how you can stomach some of the stuff that came with Trumpism. And as a matter of fact, there's someone I interviewed for this piece who you might remember, Reginald Grant, who was a delegate at the 2016 Republican convention, and he was all ready to rock and roll with the GOP. And 4 years later, after witnessing reactions to George Floyd, reactions right. to the protest and all of these things, he said, I'm out of here. And so I think that you know, there's probably somewhat of an idealistic view that, and even an overly romantic one, that accompanies people when they begin this journey into the new party.
Yeah.
It's not like new anything. So they enter with this romantic idea that, you know, and of course, on the side of the Republicans are saying, yeah, tell me what we need to do, is the same way that someone would look at you becoming the RNC chair and say, okay, that's great. We've got Michael Steele. So now there's going to be a flood of Black voters coming our way. I think all of that, I think that that kind of naive idea that you find, you know, across racial lines, that, I mean, almost as naive as the idea, okay, we've got the first Black president, racism is going to end.
Right.
All of that kind of, I would say, I don't even want to call it naive because I don't want to insult it, but that is, you know, those romantic notions about.
Yeah, it's more of a, yeah. Do. Yeah,
and I think that idealism. You know, that idealism that really does, I think, have a big part in what leads people. And I think what happens when they get there, they are shocked when it's difficult to change things. Perhaps they put blinders on to some extent. In particular, if they find their own avenues of growth from, you know, even their own business and other things. So I think that that's what makes that happen. You know, I want to go back to one other thing that you said that just one of the things that I saw, I want to return to one of your questions. I'm sorry to backtrack. In Search of Black America was the affinity to entrepreneurship within the African American community, and even the idea that entrepreneurship is a route to freedom from racial from individualized,
right.
It provides a path to an individualistic way to live as an African American, to bypass some of the degradation that's still out there. And I think that was very widespread cross country. And I think that also, there's a layer of that that feeds into African American men, who even in some years have been shown in larger numbers to start small businesses than any other population, that there is a large number of, or there is a number of Black men who have an affinity to the Republican Party that grows out of that entrepreneurship. And that's something that I saw back in the late 90s, the early 2000s, that I see the residue of that or elements of that in this movement of some men toward the GOP.
You actually, in an interview that you did on the heels of In Search of Black America, you were quoted as saying, I don't see a threat, a great rush of Black people into the Republican Party happening. I think it's healthy to have people in both parties, and I don't think it's healthy for African Americans to think they have to belong to one party. And if they don't, they'll lose everything they've gained. On the other hand, I don't think people should become Republicans just to do it. There has to be something in the party that appeals to the individual. And it's interesting that in this day and age, it is that sort of entrepreneurial kicker that seems to be the gateway opportunity that African-American men are latching onto. But when you walk through that gate, there's a whole lot of other stuff that you've got to step over. and... I don't know if people recognize how much they got to step over some stuff before you get to that point to realize all of that, because the party has no platform. The party hasn't spoken to entrepreneurism and wealth creation and all of that. Since 2015, at least.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting narrative, but you were prescient in understanding and appreciating what you were seeing in the late 90s, early 2000s, that actually has kind of played itself out today.
No, it is. You know, that's the thing. I mean, it goes back to just the, the marketing of the party in that regard and the association that people have. They associate the growth of the private sector, and actually we won't even just stop at growth of the private sector and the trickle down.
So
that is something that is associated, in a popularized way, and that's the thing that pulls people in. And it's interesting because it's not just this small population of Black men who are leaving the Democratic Party who are arrested by that idea. I mean, you find that among many whites who are there. And, I also think that another population, and this is moving away a little bit from just Black men, but when you look at the Obama-Trump voters, those voters who voted for Obama and then Trump, which in some of the polling shows that they had a stronger liking to Obama than they did Trump. But nevertheless, many of them are drawn to figures. And, for them, there are Black men, some who told me who like Trump, younger Black men, who have this feeling about Trump that's very much, very, very much in praise of his, the machismo, and all of the just the kind of tell it like it is,
how did they rationalize because in the piece that you wrote for Rolling Stone, you talked to a number of men, and you also make the point out that in the Georgia gubernatorial race, for example, 94% of Black women voted for Stacey Abrams, but only 86% of Black men did. And you're seeing that that throughout the political system, you go on to talk, according to AP Votecast, also found that 14% of all Black voters cast ballots for GOP congressional candidates, compared with an overall figure of 8%. In 2018 and 2020. Now, it's presumed that a significant portion of that 14% were the Black men who came out and voted that way. But it's interesting to see how Black men are dissecting the politics. In other words, different from their women, from the women in the community. And what does that mean? And what could it potentially lead to for both parties?
I think you hit on something really... was a little even premature in my piece, that we have to begin to look at, is this trend going to spread to Black women in any way?
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly there were more, not many more, and definitely not in Georgia, I don't think. But I mean, mm-hmm. again, some of them are preliminary and not as, they'll have a stronger, with later numbers, of course, always provide a stronger view. But it does appear, based on exit polling from across the country, that it's clear that there was a larger number of Black men going Republican. But it also seems that in some states there were a larger number of Black women.
right,
or either combined with more African-American men and women who stayed home. And that is, again, not as that's not based on the comprehensive data that we should receive, within a few months from now. But I think that's going to be something that's interesting to see, that in terms of forecasting this trend, how much of a growth it will be. I also think a lot of it will depend on really the handling of Trump by the GOP and how far Trump goes. And then, when you also will look at DeSantis, who does not have a record that when you really begin to dig in, of course, and you look at, the way in which his reaction to incarceration and voting, he also is, despite his differences with Trump, he is very much a product of Trumpism in a lot of his.
Yeah, but you're going to find, I bet, with him, with someone like him, that, and as we've seen this with other candidates or Trump style candidates, is they don't get the benefit of the doubt the way Trump gets it. So while Black folks will not going to speak broadly here, while those Black men specifically who think Trump is all that in a bag of whatever, they may not feel that way about DeSantis. So they will hold him to a standard that's very different from the one they hold Trump.
Agree. Very good point. Yeah. And, so I think that is going to be an interesting, that's what makes this a challenge to really to forecast. And then, of course, looking at this on the presidential level, is what's going to happen with the Democrats. And, I talked to what will happen with Biden.
Right.
And will Biden be able to market what he's done?
I want to hold that thought. Because I want to get into that a little bit more. We're going to take a quick little sidetrack here because I got to make some people happy. When we come back, we're going to finish up our conversation with David Dent, who is professor of journalism and social and cultural analysis at NYU University, New York University. And I'm really enjoying this because I got a little follow-up question for David when we come back right after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and thank you for being a part of fascinating conversation with Professor David Dent of the New York University. We're talking about the emergence of Black men, specifically within the political class, if you will, for Republicans. And a lot of people are kind of, scratching their heads or jumping up and down with joy. Either way, it presents some very interesting data and conversation around what trend lines we should be paying attention to and what it potentially means. From your analysis, Professor, what do you think this means for the future of the party, potentially, given what we've already laid out? You know, like I said, you know, it's great to come into the room. Let's step through the door. But when you step through, you got to step over, you know, your grandparents came from shithole countries. They're fine people on both sides. David Duke. I don't know David Duke. Oh, yeah. Oh, dinner with Fuentes and Kanye, talking about, you know, embracing Nazis and anti-Semitism. How does this play out?
There's so much that smells. I mean,
it does.
I mean, I think that my idealistic answer to your question,
right,
would be that the Black Republicans would not just step into the room out of the, you know, out of kind of some of the superficial things that draw them, but would look at possibly joining forces with someone like Larry Hogan.
Right.
Or, you know, when you look at, or Mitt Romney even, when you look across the country at, you know, members of the party, you know, maybe even partially in the spirit of the, you know, late John McCain, you know, that would try to look at refurbishing that piece and that part, because this country needs more than one party.
Right.
You know, I mean, and not just for, you know, African Americans.
Right. I think we need more than two. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another line of discussion too.
Right.
But you know, that there are spaces within the party. That, I mean, there's so many people within the party who, you know, who I've talked to who voted for Obama both times, but have stayed Republican, remained Republican. You know, and that went on to vote for Hillary and even Biden some.
But, you know, can I go back to a point you just made? What's interesting about what you just said about black Republicans who voted for Obama both times, and Colin Powell famously comes to mind, right, as a black Republican who went for Obama. Exactly. Why? It's always struck me that the party never got that. They you know, they get it when a white Democrat decides to become a Republican, or a black Democrat decides to become a Republican. They kind of shut down when the opposite becomes true, and not really try to understand what Colin Powell was saying at that time. Just that when I endorsed Joe Biden, it's the same thing. And yeah, I get it as a national chairman is, I guess, is a big deal for some people, but they were missing the point of what I was saying about our nominee, which was he's unfit for office. Run away from this. Do not engage anymore. Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah.
What is it about the party that, because I think in the arch of this conversation, that is going to be, among some other things we could probably get into, a big problem, because they don't know how to reconcile that piece, that black connection to one of our own achieving that kind of opportunity and success. We just don't see that. Oh, that's a party moment. You know, I gotta stay with the party because, yeah, that's bigger than Barack. No, Barack is bigger than the party in that moment.
Yeah. You know, I what's interesting there is, I think the Republicans have been locked on Willie Horton strategy.
Yeah.
That has, in fact, really crippled the party's ability to grow. And just when you're a party that believes your success is tied to a strategy, I mean, that is, you know, whether it be Willie Horton, or you could even look back at other, you could even go back to Reagan's welfare queen, you know, when that strategy works for you, it's hard to imagine, it's hard for your imagination of something better and different.
Right. Growing.
And I think that that is a big, that's one of the biggest things that I think really impairs both parties at this moment. I mean, in other ways, does it cripple the Democrats to some extent? And I think that that is really, you don't see, I mean, you know, Colin Powell's an excellent example. And if you also just look at the fondness and appeal of a Colin Powell, and what that could mean for the party, you know, in terms of, or what it could have meant for the party,
yeah,
the Republican Party. So I mean, I really think that it is, it's kind of a lack of imagination and a lack of, one of the things you really, I always, you know, I always credit Barack Obama with, is after reading Dreams from My Father, and there's a section in the beginning where he talks about his grandparents not being New England Transcendentalists, and his grandparents, you know, not being, you know, typical liberals, but they were able to embrace him and raise him, and also, you know, embrace his father to some extent. I mean, there's was been debates about that a little bit, but, and, you know, that I think had a part of Obama's imagination to see the possibility.
Right.
Of, you know, that was, I think, really, and people I've interviewed in Iowa about that for another project I'm working on, you know, all, you know, there was something powerful about the Obamas as they traveled through Iowa and connected with people. And their capacity to make those connections, I would say, is part, or in large part, of their imagination that it could happen. When, as you know, probably we both grew up in a time where the question, will there ever be a Black president, was a question to ask.
Right.
And
now it's, will there ever be a Black president again?
Again, right, right. But you know, I think that, you know, it's that that kind of imagination in politics. Now, there are limitations we would, that we could see in the Obama presidency, in, you know, over trying to reach across this aisle and all of that. But just the having the vision to go beyond, you know, our normative thinking.
Right.
That you have to appeal to the racism in people or the insecurities in people in order to get them to stay in the Republican Party. Therefore, you know, therefore, a Colin Powell or even white figures such as Larry Hogan are, you know, do not really embody the vision of what the party could be.
So that's that. That brings me to one of the moments during my chairmanship where there was some considerable discussion and debate. And of course, like Reagan in his debate with the State Department and the national security apparatus, when he went to Berlin and wanted to say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And they were like, oh, you can't do that. So he write it in and they take it out. He write it back in, they take it out. It's crazy because they forget he's the one who's delivering the speech. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether you take it out. So I had one of those moments, and it had to do with when I was national chairman, with declaring that the Southern strategy was over, that the party would no longer adhere to a strategy in which we would make a direct appeal to white Southern men. In fact, the goal would be to broaden the scope of that appeal to include everyone who calls themselves an American. and we would accept Republicans where we found them, as we found them, not creating them in our image of what a Republican or a conservative is, but accepting their definition of how they're living their lives and their experience. And that was, there was a lot of, oh my God, there he goes, you know, he's not a conservative. What the hell is he doing? I told you he couldn't run anything. And I listened and I went to the National Press Club and gave my speech and said that very same thing. So I'm curious as to, because you talk about kind of, you know, pushing outside from the sort of the normative to sort of create an opportunity. Many of us have tried that, some more successful than others, some having the opportunities that, you know, that I not having the opportunities that I've had to do it. How would you assess the first Black chairman of the Republican National Committee?
Good question. I think you taught us a lot. You know,
Now, just for the audience to know, this is not, this is not patty cake time. I want honest, like, dude, you'd screwed that up or you could have, because I think it's, I mean, I've never really asked anybody that question. So this is the first time I'm asking the question, you know, objectively to hear how others saw what I did or tried to do outside of the Washington bubble.
I'll be totally honest. I mean, I saw it as a milestone. I saw it a little bit, I guess there's a cynicism that also accompanied, you know, and not necessarily towards you, but more so toward the party, when I said this is reactive to Obama. I also remember, you know, that was after, what was it, the autopsy? Oh, no, that wasn't.
No, that was before. The autopsy was after I left, right?
Came after you left. That's right. It came after you left. You know, I thought what was fascinating is that you did not take on that position with the idea that you were going to roll with the party in the way they want to roll.
Bravo.
You know, I mean, I think that
you just summed it up.
That was the admirable thing. Now, there's some people who look at that and found that to be, you know, well, why didn't he know that? Why would he think that? I mean, I think that what I credit with that is that it takes imagination to really begin transformation. And sometimes we're going to imagine things and it ain't going to work. It ain't, right. You know, it ain't right. Gonna, it's the going back the other way. But so, I mean, I think this was kind of one of those moments where we said, okay, let's try to make this change. Let's try to build, let's try to, you know, refurbish and rebuild this in another way.
Right.
And, you know, the powers of the red power, so to speak, were not open to that. They were open to the symbolism, but not the substance of your presence. And I think that is something that, you know, it's kind of, it parallels, I guess, Reginald Grant to some extent. I mean, you know, there are people that would see, he really, you know, conservatism is something that's really steeped into his perspective.
Sure.
On the, in terms of the economy, strong military, you know, it is, the views that the party says, but that does not, that they don't necessarily, that they don't adhere to, are really kind of his values. That I think when you come in with a more romantic view like that, you know, maybe you can create the change. Maybe you will end up saying bye. Right. And, you know, the and who knows, there could be another time to I say, when you look at, you know, the elements, Cheney, when you look at when you look at elements of the party that are not reduced to kind of the Southern strategy, the race,
right,
that want to go forward in another direction. The person who can mobilize that part and, you know, and really is going to be a political figure to be remembered in history. Whenever, if that happens, that's going to be transformative. I mean, if you look at different moments of partisanships, whoever does that is going to really, and I think there is room for that. The formula is tricky at this point, but I would not say never.
Right. Well, I don't say never. Just not now. because you know, I just don't see that individual or individuals emerging right now because of how much the Trump infection has metastasized inside the party, where it's no longer about Trump. It's about what Trumpism is and what it's doing. It's, you know, it's how the Marjorie Taylor Greens co-opt the Kevin McCarthy's. It's how the Mitch McConnell's remain silent in the face of the Matt Gaetz, or even more signifying where things are as we kind of move off of Trump and onto something else or someone else. It's how a Governor DeSantis remains silent in the face of the former president, titular head of the Republican Party, sitting down and breaking bread with two white nationalist Nazi types.
Something. Yeah, no, I agree. That to me leaves us with, you know, from a rational perspective, there does not seem to be any choice unless you are some kind of visionary that is ready, you know, and, you know, some might say if you claim to be that today, I mean, when you were there, it was right after Obama was elected. You know, today we've got now the history of Trumpism and, you know, its flirtations with anti-Semitism. It's, you know, what it's done to white nationalism,
right?
And all of that. I mean, who could dare think that they can come in and change that without a massive, a massive strategy?
So, right on that point, one last question before I let you roll up out of here. How did the Herschel Walker campaign and Herschel Walker himself impact the country's view of Black Republicans?
I think it had a negative. I think it definitely
certainly brought out the cynicism.
It did, and certainly there were. There were those who joined and been. You know, I'm just talking about the African American Republicans that I interviewed in Georgia,
right.
You know, there were many who gave you the party line and would not, but then would want to go on background off record. Oh, it's
and tell you what they really think.
Tell you what they really think.
How many conversations have we had like that, right?
Yeah, but they did not want to say that. On record. Well, right. we have all types of Republicans. We're a big tent, and we're a tent big enough for Herschel Walker. I mean, that is, you know, that's that's absurd, of course, but I think it had a negative in Georgia. I'm not sure how across the country, there are people who dismiss it as just, you know, a fumble that both parties have had candidates, Black or white, who have been wackos. Although more Republican wackos, one would have to say, and that it is, it's just, you know, par for the course.
Right.
I think for political junkies like the two of us, and for Georgia residents, it had a very negative.
Right.
And it's the kind of thing that I think prevents more African-Americans from considering what those African-American men who switched over have done.
Begs the question for 2024, right? It really kind of really puts in play the vote that is becoming more and more of a swing vote for both parties. And then we, you know, you watch the emergence and the establishment of the Hispanic political class and how they begin to move in the system. It's going to create some really interesting conversations over the next few years, and a lot for individuals like you to observe and to analyze. Professor David Dent, thank you so much for taking time to come in and share your insights from your work. He is the author of the book In Search of Black America, and has written a fascinating piece that you can check out, folks, site of Rolling Stone website, Why Are More Black Men Voting Republican? Thanks a lot, Professor. Really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. This is a great conversation.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. And you can track the professor's work on Twitter at David J. Dent, NYU. Again, check out his piece in Rolling Stone. And if you get a chance, go back and grab a copy of that of his book, In Search of Black America. I think it will help put in perspective a lot of what you see unfolding today, because he had his finger on a very important pulse then, which is still beating and playing itself out 20 some odd years later. That does it for this time together, folks. Always appreciate it when you have a chance to drop in and say hello. Again, we want to welcome and thank our guest, Professor Dent. And do that wonderful thing I always love you to do, that download thing. You know, you make me feel all warm inside when you do. Check us out on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Follow the podcast on Twitter at Steele underscore podcast. And until next time, be safe. Get ready for the holidays. It's here. All right. Don't forget that list. You got to check it off, right? You got to make sure you get it all together, because otherwise you're going to have some really pissed off people on Christmas Day, probably starting with you. So enjoy the holidays, folks. We'll catch up with you soon. Take care.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.